The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the H.J. Heinz Company Foundation. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music. Here's a song we hear only every 4 years, but it evokes so many sights and feelings of the Olympics. You can almost see that runner coming into the arena and ascending those steps with torch in hand to light the Olympic flame that begins the games.
Yeah. Happy birthday to you.
It's not the Mormon Happy Tabernacle Choir, I'll tell you that. It's a song that we're all familiar with. Happy birthday. Everybody's heard that from the time you were a little person.
Happy birthday to you.
I don't think there's a person in the world who hears that song that doesn't think of the circus, of course. All the elephants, the animals, all kinds of things that go on in the circus, the clowns, and just the pageantry of it all, and the fun you had, especially as a kid. What does it mean? What does music mean? How do we make music? And why do we love one kind of music and we hate another kind? I'm Paul Anthony, and this time on The Nature of Music, we're exploring music and meaning. Music has powerful meanings for all of us. On this program, we'll ask the whys and hows of musical meaning. How does New Orleans jazz offer us a model for order in our society? Why did people who have never owned a classical record go out and buy Mozart after they saw the movie Amadeus? And how can music videos actually help us find our own interpretation of a song? Definitely an old sound, but kind of an up sound, huh? The sound of ragtime. But to a listener at the turn of the century, ragtime stood for a definite social setting, a setting that was forbidden to mainstream America. Anthropologist Donald Brennus.
In fact, if a demure daughter of a middle-class family in St. Louis, whether white or black, sat down at the piano and started playing a rag, there would be a lot of meaning in the question, where did you learn that?
If that demure young maiden had purchased the sheet music at her local store, no one could accuse her of hanging around bawdy houses or honky-tonks. The social stigma had vanished. Brenna says that putting the music on paper literally sanitized it for middle-class America.
Transcribing, composing on paper and the like, first, it shifts the kind of discourse it is. It makes it recognizably, at least within the great Western art music tradition, or even the popular music tradition of that period, wouldn't be written down. You know, the fact that it's written down changes its nature, but it also gives you a legitimate way of learning it.
Music symbolizes social class, according to Brennus, and musical groups sometimes stand for social structures, like a corporation or a family.
One reason people loved rock and roll bands was their images of community. You see this tightly integrated kind of group out there that's doing something individually virtuosic. You know, they're strutting their own stuff, but more than that, they're really doing it together in a very heightened, foregrounded way. What kinds of meanings do we see or do we take? And maybe taking is the answer in a way. What kinds of meanings do we take from the fact that they begin together, they end together, they almost move together physically as well as musically when they're doing it.
But, says Brennis, the image of community isn't the only one you find in musical groups.
Think of the image of community that a symphonic orchestra provides. You've got the director up there, and you have the orchestra down there, and you have section leaders and various hierarchical distinctions internally, but it's basically an I lead, you follow image being presented.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the violins and woodwinds, please remember we try to make a crescendo on each trill. Before three, one, two, three, four, five, six, and eight bars, no?
Jazz critic Martin Williams finds a different kind of social structure in small jazz ensembles. He sees each musician keeping his own individuality in these groups while working toward a common goal.
Jazz musicians have discovered that this high individuality that each of them requires of himself can work cooperatively in a group. I mean, when you think that the very earliest jazz style we know anything about, the New Orleans style, the so-called Dixieland style, you've got as many as seven people with very individual styles all improvising at once. And this works as a self-contained piece of music and not a kind of sloppy musical chaos. Well, that's astonishing.
I'll play that thing!
Vintage jazz from King Oliver and his Creole jazz band. While Martin Williams dwells on the social aspects of music, musicologist Terence O'Grady thinks all music has an ideological meaning. For example,
any late Romantic 19th century orchestral work in the art music tradition has a very solid ideological lining. It reinforces and perpetuates the values of the middle and upper middle class, both of that day and of the present day. It shows the predilection for education, for cultural improvement, for refinement, a certain amount of intellect, a certain amount of emotion, just the sort of mixture of experience that upper middle class people find enlightening and elevating.
O'Grady also has an interpretation of why Mozart appeals to certain listeners.
Here is music which is pleasant. It's preoccupied with a certain sort of formal correctness. It is music which, more than probably anything else, is polite. It is very obvious from listening to most Mozart, and of course there are some wonderful exceptions, that its genius lies in the subtle manipulation of conventions. And these conventions are, for the most part, presented in a way which speaks of politeness and refinement, just the sort of values that the middle class likes to assign to itself.
And what about the movie Amadeus? Why did it appeal to people who weren't listening to classical music?
Well, I think Amadeus was so popular because it allowed people to humanize Mozart in such a way that they could relate to him as somebody who was a genius, but on the other hand, who obviously had personality flaws. You know, how you can never be in any way intimidated by Mozart after you've seen that movie. I know lots of people who were not particularly enthusiastic about classical music. They went to see Amadeus, and they now have rather massive Mozart collections. Now, whether they're listening to this music seriously or with any modicum of intensity, I have no idea. But apparently was just enough of this sort of elevated status that had traditionally been assigned to Mozart. There was enough of this that they felt they were unable to approach it. They wanted to approach it. They knew there was something sort of culturally improving about classical music. But there was just, you know, one or two more hurdles to hurdle. And as soon as they saw Amadeus, all of a sudden the music becomes something not above you, not something which you have to reach out to, but something which is, if not exactly below you, at least right next to you and something that you can master. So I think, yeah, there is an ideological link there too.
Mozart didn't change, says O'Grady. The audience's perception of him did. critics have their perceptions too, sometimes prejudiced, and they pass these along to their readers. O'Grady says a good example of this is the case of Jelly Roll Morton.
Before critics spoke of Jelly Roll Morton in the way which made him seem as if he was somehow an originator and a master at amalgamating styles, he was just thought to be another talented composer working in a minor, lower-class idiom. But as soon as particularly white critics of the middle class who have been trained in the correct vocabulary to use, who are very fluent in speech and fluent in their writing, as soon as they recognize that Jelly Roll Morton has accomplished all these things, all of a sudden his credibility has just increased by leaps and bounds. Not a single one of his musical values has changed, but all of a sudden those musical values are seen to be significant both historically and even aesthetically, only because he has attracted a new group of admirers, that is to say, white middle-class intellectuals who are capable of putting their thoughts in very elaborate, complex terms. And as soon as the terms in which you write about something become elaborate and complex, it is assumed that the art about which you write has also become elaborate and complex, even though, of course, the style hasn't changed at all. So why is it no longer considered to be low-class entertainment? Why is it now considered to be something worthy of studying in the universities, worthy of the time of middle-class white intellectuals? What's changed? And, of course, the only thing that's changed is a certain sort of leader group has given it credibility by embracing it, and that the rest of us sheep sort of mindlessly follow along once that leader group has established it as credible. We follow along, and we too are eager, in fact, sometimes fall over one another in an attempt to reinforce that credibility.
It's probably impossible to say that one music is better than another music from a purely objective viewpoint, whatever that might be. We put values on music, says O'Grady, depending on our background, the movies we've seen, the critics we follow, and so on. Charles Kyle of Buffalo, New York, is the author of Urban Blues. Kyle thinks that the Afro-American music we now call the blues was perceived by mainstream America differently in other times. These perceptions ranged from non-recognition to universal understanding of the human emotions expressed in the blues.
I got to keep moving, I got to keep moving. Blues falling down like hail, blues falling down.
The whole category of blues is basically at the inception, back in the World War I period, is basically a white label for a feeling that gets put upon Afro-Americans and that they cope with. They deal with that stereotype and they create a hell of a lot of good music. Between 1928 and the late 1960s, blues is a recognizable and powerful style. But I think it's a working through of stereotypes that come from outside, a transcending of those stereotypes, and finally that blues feeling is something that every human being knows about deep in their hearts, and it's not an Afro-American monopoly at all. It's something that we have, and each person has that quality in their voice if they'll search for it, if they'll dig deep and bring it out.
To pass the time away, to pass the time away.
I'm Paul Anthony, and this is The Nature of Music. On this program, we're talking about the meaning of music, the meaning we give music personally, the way those meanings are influenced by opinion makers, and the changing values that society puts on a particular music. Kyle thinks that a social group can actually choose a certain music as a social badge, as something that says who they are. Take the polka.
The people who came here as immigrants came with a whole bunch of dances and musics other than the polka. The Poles alone brought 40 or 50 different regional dance styles with them when they got off the boat, some of them. There were Krakowiaks and Polonaises and Kujawiaks, and Lord knows how many different dances were being done in the Polish-American community in Buffalo in the 1870s and 80s and 90s from all different corners of Poland. And the polka emerges in the 1920s as a kind of common denominator choice. of we have to have a sound that identifies us as ethnic working class people in the USA. There's all this jazz going on. It's the jazz age, and the Afro-Americans have their thing. What's our thing? And people chose a kind of restricted repertoire of polka, waltz, and oberic as their set of dance tunes that they were going to stick with and develop. So in a sense, it was reinvented in the 1920s as a style to demarcate a particular ethnic community.
Kyle finds another important meaning people sometimes give to music. When he was studying the music of the Tiv in Nigeria, he asked a basic sort of question. Why do you make songs?
When I asked that question to a Tiv composer, he said, "Hey, don't you have any problems in your country?" His response was, "Wherever there are problems, there's going to be music." People address problems through music and find a kind of instant solace, instant soothing of hurt feelings in sound. I think one of the things we underestimate is the amount of aggression, anger, hurt that people can either assuage through music or put into music and transform through music. That whole negative, angry, resistant side has been glossed over in our kind of conventional wisdom about what music is about. It's beautiful, it's transcendent, it's all these nice things, but it's also a vehicle for releasing pent-up anger, aggression, hurt feelings. A lot of negative emotions can be turned into something good through music.
Black lung, oh, your hands I see cold. As you reach for my life and you torture my soul, cold as that water hole down in that dark cave where I spent my life's blood digging my own grave. Down at the graveyard, the boss man came with his little bunch of flowers. Dear God, what a shame. Take back those flowers. Don't you sing those sad songs. The die has been cast now. A good man is gone.
That was Hazel Dickens, a coal miner's daughter, doing what the Tiv do, singing a protest song. So, the meaning of the music is taken by the listener or put there by the performer. But when video comes into the picture, like the current trend in music videos, doesn't that preempt the listener's personal interpretation of the song? MTV critic Michael Shore thinks so.
Just sitting in front of a TV, you automatically go into a semi-stupor anyway most of the time without even realizing it. You know, there's that whole phenomenon right there. So right away, I mean, a part of your brain is being turned off just by the very nature of sitting there watching TV, okay? But even beyond that, I get really annoyed when if there's a song that's a hit and you don't like it, but because you hear it so much everywhere you go, you end up, you know, you're walking down the street and you catch yourself singing it to yourself, you know? Now, the next step in the video age is, when you sing it to yourself, then you catch yourself picturing images from the damn video in your head, you know. And I consider that like an invasion of my privacy after a while, you know. If there's a band that I hate and all of a sudden I see their ugly lead singer in my mind, I mean, I get mad, you know. It's like I don't want to be victimized by this kind of thing, you know. But, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to, like, throw your TV out the window and never watch it again? I mean, you can't do that. You know, maybe you could, but I'm not going to, you know.
Anthropologist Marina Rosen.
A criticism of MTV is that it makes the song so apparent that there's no room for imagination. Red skies at night. Red skies at night. But I've played several MTV. There was one, let's see, what did we do? We did The Fix. And I had three or four different interpretations of what that music video was about. So while it's adding information, putting some kind of new idea of what a song is about before the public, it's also offering a chance, another set of devices, visual devices to go with the audio devices that can complexify the issue and lead to whole new layers of symbolic interpretation. And you'll get 3, 4, 5 interpretations of one music video and what that music video is about. So I don't think that it's cutting off their ability to integrate information. It's not necessarily cutting off their ability to be creative with that information. It may, in fact, be providing a new format for people to become creative with songs by responding also now to symbolic visuals as well as symbolic texts, for example.
We're talking about the meanings we put into music or take out of it. Canadian musical philosopher R. Murray Schafer has some ideas about the meaning of music. He's unhappy with certain educators who rob music of what he calls its gut-level power.
That spiritual, that magical quality that music has, that enormous sort of Dionysian power that it has to affect us, is something that is so powerful that it's really dreaded, usually, by conservative establishments. That's the reason that rock and roll is a music that's considered outside of music. It isn't normally taught at schools and universities. What is taught is a kind of an emaciated music that seeks its justification by relating it to cognitive learning, to science, to reading skills, and things of that sort.
Schafer is so concerned about this kind of teaching that he goes to schools and does experiments with the children. At one school, he told them, I'm going to give you a word association test.
The word is music. And 70% of the kids in that class wrote down notes. They wrote down notes, or else they wrote down things like composition or writing. A few of them wrote down the name of their teacher or something.
If Schafer gave the test to Stanley Sadie, he'd probably get back more than one word. Sadie edited the 20-volume New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. Music often unifies a social group, says Sadie, and brings everyone to the same way of thinking, a sort of brainwashing.
Brainwashed isn't quite the word, but in a sense it is. I mean, they're being brain-conditioned, let's say, to being of a unity, of a like-mindedness, and this has a valuable function, a social function of welding groups together, of creating a form of unity, whether it's a big crowd singing the Internationale or whether it's a group in a Buddhist temple listening to a very prolonged spell of chant.
In other circumstances, according to Sadie, one shouldn't be surprised to find many responses to the same music, all of them equally individual.
Meaning is in the ear of the beholder, really, you know. It's not something that's built in necessarily to a piece of music. You know, there's this famous business of Mozart's G minor symphony, which to Schumann was a sort of lofty beauty. Other people feel it's passionate, and one modern commentator says it's full of the spirit of comic opera. But the point is that the reaction isn't, as it were, a pure one. It's conditioned by past experience, by other associations of a like kind, and so on.
When it comes to the meaning of music, Beethoven had a phrase, Ausdruck der Empfindung. Does Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony tell a story, an example of what they call program music? Jacques Barzin, the eminent humanist and historian, thinks that Beethoven had it right. Music has no specific meaning.
The whole question of program music was foolishness, because music cannot tell a story and cannot reproduce a scene. It cannot say, here we are at Elsinore, and this is the castle, and this young man is named Hamlet. Those are articulated ideas and impressions. But somehow music, for example, somebody wrote a good Hamlet overture, you would have the sense, whatever that may mean, the feeling that you were in some imposing place, or that here was an individual of importance striding along. It wouldn't tell you this. It would give you the impression that you would feel if you were told. That's what Beethoven meant by his remark. Not painting, but the expression of sensation, of impression. Ausdruck der Empfindung.
The ultimate question about the meaning of music might be, where did music come from, or why did we invent music? Anthropologist David McAllister thinks it might have been that humans sang to each other before they talked. Music, says McAllister, has a magic which can transform, which can change an everyday act into something powerful.
Because music enhances every act, makes it more meaningful, makes it more persuasive, and associates it with all kinds of symbols that are hard to resist. If you come in the evening with a rose between your teeth and stand under her window with a guitar in your hand, that's a sculptural symbol that has to do with music, and it's much more impressive than if you just said, how about we get married?
Oh, mistress mine, where are you roaming? Oh, mistress mine, where are you roaming? Oh, stay and hear your true love's calling. Oh, stay and hear your true love's calling, that can sing both high and low.
You go through a whole complex set of acts. She thinks of Romeo and Juliet. She thinks of all kinds of things and associates you with all these things which have their power, and they lend their force to the persuasion. And we come back again to magic. This is a kind of magic. You make a thing more powerful than it would be by itself.
If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series, or information on how to order a cassette or a transcript of this program on music and meaning, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Here's that address again. The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Don't forget to mention the call letters of the station you are listening to and the title of this program, Music and Meaning. Our program on Music and Meaning is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. John Widoff is the mix engineer. Michael Wilpers is the research assistant. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. The Nature of Music series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. I'm Paul Anthony. This is NPR, National Public Radio.